Larry Gibson and Dennis Golay both tested positive for HIV over 20 years ago. At the time, they were partners. Also at that time, the doctors told them both that they had just months to live. Dennis and Larry are still very much with us and with each other. They've been through some pretty tough times, fighting off infections and surviving years of experimental drugs. They are now in their early 60s, and they are the oldest surviving couple that they know of. These days, they're facing the fact that they are aging a lot faster after what they've been through.
Our faces are drawn and sort of skeletal, you know, from the drugs. They do that.
It has affected our appearances, most definitely, but it hasn't affected our smiles. They're still the same, and they still mean the same. And, you know, and that twinkling in the eyes that we've always had with each other and for each other, that's still the same. That hasn't ever changed. Maybe it's brighter now than it's ever been, really.
Dennis Golay and Larry Gibson have faced HIV/AIDS. Now they're facing age. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
There are now more than 1 million Americans living with HIV/AIDS. 20 years ago, I couldn't have said such a thing because back then HIV/AIDS was a death sentence. But these days, people are not just living with the disease, they're growing old with it. One quarter of the people with HIV/AIDS in America today are over 50. And many are discovering that years of antiretroviral drugs are causing them to age faster than others. Now, it's not necessarily a sad story. Many of these people thought they'd be dead by now. Larry Gibson and Dennis Golay are growing old with HIV/AIDS and with each other. They've been together over 26 years. They were both living in L.A. when they met. On that particular day, Dennis was having a birthday lunch at the French Marketplace restaurant. I'll let Larry pick up the story.
It was a Saturday afternoon, Dennis's birthday, November the 14th, 1981. And as I stepped out of the car, I mean, I felt his eyes on me immediately. And I jaywalked across Santa Monica Boulevard on a busy Saturday afternoon. I don't know how I didn't get killed or get a ticket because L.A. is really, they don't like jaywalking. But I did. I kind of floated across the street. And, boy, my heart was gone then.
It was kismet, I guess. It's rare, I'm sure, in life that this really happens, but it did. It really did.
Yeah, it felt like a fateful moment, and it was.
And have you two been together pretty well since that time?
We waited a week to move in together.
This was in 1981. Tell me if at that time, finding a new boyfriend, do you even think about HIV/AIDS? Was it even something that was in the back of your mind?
It was in the back of our mind, but we really didn't know very much about it. There were rumors. On the West Coast, the news didn't get to us as quickly as it did on the East Coast. So there were rumors. There was no name for it. It was mysterious. It was hitting a group of gay men in New York. And I don't think any of us were really all that concerned because we thought we were so far removed from it, and nobody knew what it was. We figured it was something indigenous to New York and that particular community, and it turned out, obviously, that it wasn't. But no, we weren't, not then. Just a very few months later, though, we got better information and knew, yeah, this was going to be something bad.
But it was some years before either one of you got tested, is that right?
Yes. When we met in 1981, there were no treatments whatsoever other than making your last will and testament. That was about the only treatment that was available to you.
And we knew no one. We had lost no one at that point.
Exactly. We hadn't lost anybody. So we waited until 1987.
Yeah, but I had suspected, I really seriously suspected since about 1983, 84. We say we were single at both the right time and the wrong time. It was the right time for each other, but it was the wrong time for the virus.
Was there a period of time, Larry, when you avoided the testing places because...
Oh, yeah.
why know if there's not really any treatment at that point, right?
That was kind of the attitude I think we had, and I think a lot of people had. Because if there's nothing you can do, knowing is only going to ruin what little life you have left. And I think that was kind of a prevailing attitude. And that was pretty much ours. We got beyond that because then we started losing so many friends. And seeing how they were dying and what they were dying from, I think both of us realized that there must be something that could be done. There wasn't any treatment for this particular virus, but the illnesses that were killing our friends were treatable. So we could do something. And I think that's finally when we got tested.
But I do recall that driving home from work, I would pass an AIDS testing place, and the sign was out front. And a block before, I would consciously make my eyes not look at it until I was a block past it. So
I would even go around the block so I wouldn't see it at all. So
yeah, there was a time that we just didn't want to look at it.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. 21 years ago, Larry Gibson and Dennis Golay finally decided to get tested for HIV/AIDS. They went together on the same day to the same clinic.
First, you have to go through counseling before you're tested. Then you're tested. Then you have to wait. I think it was 2 weeks
Almost
or three weeks.
Yeah,
it was nearly 3 weeks, which was pretty agonizing, of course. But I think during that 3 weeks, in a way, it was a blessing because we had time to prepare, if you can prepare for that. Mm-hmm. And I think we probably knew when we tested what the results were going to be. So when we got the results, we weren't completely blown away. I think we were numb for a little while.
A bit, yeah. We're set back a bit. But we already put our systems in place about how we would handle it if we did test positive. If we tested negative, great. But if we tested positive, we already had a system in place and what we would do. And we put that to work immediately and have lived it ever since.
What did a positive test mean in 1987?
Death. In 1987, it meant death. We both went to the same doctor at the same time. And for some reason, I got to see the doctor before Larry did. And he told me, he got my lab test and told me that I was a little better than most of his patients. I might have, if I'm lucky, 18 months to live.
Wow.
He gave me 24. We fooled him, though.
Well, but you also knew friends who were getting the same kinds of words from doctors. Was the doctor also saying, you know, you've got 18 months, you've got 2 years, but just don't get sick between now and then, you know?
No, he didn't. He actually told us to go casket shopping.
You're not because, serious, did he?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah,
he actually did.
He said, make your preparations. Pick out your casket and plan your funerals. That was pretty devastating.
Yeah, it was.
What did you two say to each other?
Well
we had thought about it quite a bit. And first of all, we sat down and what are the things that we're concerned about? And we decided, well, we would do four things. So we argued back and forth. Would it be three things or four things? But I say four.
Well, the first one, though, is the most important. We would not assign blame to each other, to anybody else,
right. Period.
We just would not. We wouldn't go there ever, and we never have.
Never have. We saw the virus break up so many people because they would argue, you gave it to me, you killed me. You know, and we decided, no, we love each other too much to do that to one another. Blame is not a cure.
No. Blame doesn't do anybody any good.
Number two, we would do everything we could do to learn about it, to try to survive.
We would participate in clinical trials as they became available, investigate alternative therapies. We read constantly, it seems like. And this was really before the day of the Internet. And we held full-time jobs at the time. I was working 14 hours a day at a regular job, and so was Larry. And we were also trying to save as much money as we could because we didn't know what that meant as far as when we got too sick to work but not sick enough to die. A lot of people didn't do that. So, there are horror stories out there about that, too.
Yeah, I've talked to a couple of people who ran up huge credit card bills and have spent the past 15 years fixing the debt.
That was their way of melting down. And we did eventually have our own meltdown, but we postponed it for several years. We didn't do it with credit cards. Yeah.
Number three.
We would help in any way we could anybody. That meant not avoiding our friends. I would never fail to hug and kiss a friend. I didn't care how sick he was or if he gave it to me.
And we would embrace anybody who needed care, whatever that meant. We would do. We would help take people to the doctor's appointments, help them buy the drugs that they couldn't afford. We'd do whatever we could do.
What we decided was that when you get a death sentence like that, it gives you the opportunity to do your good works. And we still do. We didn't know it'd last this long.
What was the last thing on your list?
The last thing, which is my favorite one, that we would fight like hell to survive. But if we couldn't, failing that, we would learn how to die with peace and dignity.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Larry Gibson and Dennis Golay were both told, back in 1987, that they had HIV/AIDS. And at that time, there was no AZT. There were no antiretroviral drugs.
What we really feared more than death was the loss of us, of what we had. I mean, Dennis had turned 34 the day I met him, and I had turned 37 just 11 days previous. So we had looked for almost four decades to find that one perfect soulmate and found them. And to only have it for 7 or 8 years and then have it snatched so viciously away from us, we thought that just wasn't right. We feared that more than anything. We wanted our what we have together, which is extraordinary.
It was feeling cheated then.
We wanted it to flourish and to live its full life.
We did. We wanted to give it time and felt cheated that we weren't going to get the chance.
At that point, it was very early in the disease, and I had seen some people go a little berserk about it. Not just with AIDS, but the other people. I saw them going crying and kicking. And, I don't know, Dylan kept bouncing into my brain, you know, do not go gentle into that good night. And I didn't intend to go gentle into that good night, but I didn't want to be crying and going, I don't want to die. I wanted to go out, and I had seen an example of it. I mean, here we are, we're gay men, we're being struck down in our prime, and I've seen enough people stand up, puff out their chest, and walk bravely into the face of death and walk into the darkness with bravery and courage. And I don't know, it just impressed me so much, and I thought, that's what I want to do, you know. I don't want to be a baby about dying. I want to be a man about it.
Both Larry Gibson and Dennis Golay have spent the past 20 years avoiding death. In that time, their health has taken a beating. They have lost teeth and eyesight. They've lost weight and strength, and they've lost many other friends, but they haven't lost the will to live. Now they are a part of a new group of people that doctors are watching. They are people growing old with HIV/AIDS. And I'll talk with them about that experience, graying with AIDS, in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. There are thought to be as many as a million Americans living with HIV/AIDS today. Many of them are over the age of 50. What they're finding is that years of drug cocktails and antiretrovirals are taking a different kind of toll. These people are aging faster than their peers. Doctors who treat patients with HIV/AIDS say some such effects of aging are appearing 10, even 20 years sooner than in other people. Larry Gibson and Dennis Golay have both lived over 20 years with HIV/AIDS. Back in the mid-90s, they moved to Palm Springs to be closer to friends and to the doctors who specialize in treating people with HIV/AIDS. Dennis says there was some gallows humor in the purchase of that home.
Well, it kind of looked like a mausoleum, actually. It was a little white stucco box on a third-acre square of sand.
Of desert, yeah.
It had nothing there except this white box, and it really kind of looked like a mausoleum. When Larry and I first looked at it, I said, you know, I think we could do something with this if we have the energy, but right now it looks like we can just put the caskets in the living room and be gone. So from that point on, it got easier.
And we did. We did live in it for 2 or 3 years that way. You know, it was serviceable. And as I began to recover, we started working on it. Now, we call it the cutest house on the block. We have this Garden of Eden in the back.
Since we've lived there, I've planted, we counted them one day because somebody asked me how many trees were on the property, 47. I've planted 47 trees. Most of them are 10 years or more older.
You're seeing a height and maturity in those trees that you probably didn't anticipate you'd ever see.
Right. Well, when we fell out of the tree about a month ago, we were trimming one of our little trees that we put in, and the ladder was too short for it, and down we came. We figured out that our trees had gotten too big for us to take care of.
10 years ago, neither Larry Gibson nor Dennis Golay was very optimistic about their future. Larry says at that point, he was so close to death, he was looking into options for euthanasia.
I was below 120 pounds. I was headed towards death.
He had 16 T-cells. I don't know if you know what that means, but the cells that fight infection.
16 T-cells? I've never heard of a count that low, I don't think.
We decide if they got any lower, we're going to start naming them. But that's another story, too. They got down to 7, they would probably be the dwarfs, but anyway.
Wow.
I'm witness to how he handled that. And he was very sad because he was very ill, but he was still a man. He was very much a man, whatever that may mean. And that doesn't have anything to do against women. It means he had personal integrity and dignity about what he was going through and what the outcome of it probably would be. And I have always admired that in him.
And I contracted an opportunistic infection, which hit my right eye. And I went blind in that eye in the course of one day. And I could have had an operation, but I was so weak and ill. The doctor said, I don't think you'll survive it. So you have a choice between your eye or your life. And I made this choice to live.
Did you think you were dying, though, at that time? Did you think that you really had just a matter of weeks or months to live?
Yes, yes. And I think that Dennis did, too. And as a matter of fact, shortly after that time, I asked for help. When the time comes, will you help me? And they said yes. And
help
one
you
day
die.
Right. We're talking euthanasia here.
Yeah, yeah.
I hate to say the word. But one morning I was in and I said, I'm tired. I'm very, very, very tired. And I think I want to now. And to my great surprise, he said, yes. Okay. And I said, but wait, I can't do it until I talk to Dennis. So I went out and talked to Dennis and went to lunch, which I didn't eat much, but we went to lunch and we talked it over. And Dennis said, I just don't think it's time, hon. Just give me one more week, will you? You can stand it one more week, can't you? And I said, well, yeah, I can.
I saw something. I don't know what it was exactly, but it's not that he was rallying exactly, but it's like his progression stopped, dead cold. I don't think he could see it. I'm not even sure that the doctors could see it, but I sensed something. And I just had a feeling that there was a possibility that this new drug that he was on might start working or might at least give him a little time until something else came along. And it did take about a week, and he actually started to feel a little bit better. He got a little bit of color in his face. His numbers hadn't improved, but they hadn't gotten any worse either. So from that point on, we just put that decision on the back burner.
Right. A week became two, became a lot more than that. Right?
Exactly.
After the week, I said, I think I can make it another month. He says, okay, yeah, I've got you for another month, promise. I said, yes.
Do you guys think about that? Do you think about how close you were, Larry, though, to...
Yeah. Yeah, I think about it. Sure I do. How can you not think about it? You know, Dick, it's not that bad. When you're coming up to it, it really isn't. You know, you hear these stories about people who find their serenity. And literally, the worst thing that I was thinking of, the one thing that upset my heart the most was Dennis, you know, having to leave him behind and what he would have to go through. It is a strange situation. You don't think so much of yourself when you think you have just a matter of days. You think about those that are closest to you, those you love the most.
That's very, very true because, you know, we're soulmates. We're very, very close. And one of us dying was going to be devastating for the other one. So I know just exactly what he means.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. While Dennis Golay was helping his partner, Larry Gibson, he had to wrestle with the effects of his own HIV/AIDS. Dennis says that all their health problems became dramatically magnified because their immune systems were so compromised.
They had a gallstone the size of a golf ball, supposedly, which laid me up for nearly a year. It was a very, very long recovery for something like gallstone surgery. Yeah. It shouldn't have been.
And he's forgetting that he had this huge hump on the back of his neck. I mean, it was huge.
I kind of looked like the Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
it was huge. It started in the middle of the back of my head and went all the way down between my shoulder blades.
At that time, nobody knew about it. And we would go to the doctor and they would say, no, it's not a tumor. It's not this. But we knew something was very desperately wrong. And finally, Dennis told me to shut up about it because I wanted to find out what was going on. You know, I'm like a dog with a bone. And he went online and actually found a reference to it and found that there was a doctor in Los Angeles that was doing a study on it. We hooked up with him, and he's humpless today.
Yeah, that's been 15 years ago, yeah.
And they did that, Dennis, while you still had AIDS, right?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
I thought that there were some things that they wouldn't do because fear of infection or that sort of thing.
Well, there is that. That exists in a lot of areas of the country. I guess we are very fortunate to live in a, I'm not sure that we're fully enlightened, but in this way, we are a rather enlightened part of the country. And we don't suffer from that quite so much.
Yeah.
I hear horror stories of people in the Midwest. I'm from Indiana myself. About doctors who won't even let you in the door, won't even let you make an appointment, certainly won't touch you. I have never, ever experienced any of that. Having been diagnosed in Los Angeles, I went to an AIDS doctor who was specializing in it to begin with. So I was always guided toward people who would accept me.
Dennis Golay had a heart attack last year. He's also had major bypass surgery. Larry's been through a gruesome run with chemotherapy to help him treat hepatitis C. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Both Dennis and Larry Gibson are in their early 60s, and they're among people who've been through this long series of experimental drugs as researchers sorted through the successes and failures of early drug treatments for people with HIV/AIDS. It was really just a few years ago when the two men concluded that they might not be living out a prolonged death sentence.
We were starting more to think about planning for the future, planning to let's go to Europe someday, and things like that. We had never even talked about that for so many years.
Actually, it did impact us in a number of ways, because we got to talking about it. Look, we've had this a long time. We're still alive. We're aging with AIDS.
The things that people encounter as they normally age, AIDS patients were going to see earlier. And we could see it coming. We'd seen it in our friends who were still living, and that wasn't very many of them, but the ones that were still living were having heart problems, and I had a heart attack last year, but I was 59. My cardiologist has a number of patients who have had age-related heart attacks caused primarily by medications as young as 42.
Do you see this in each other? Do you see this sort of advanced aging as a result of taking these drugs when you look at each other?
No, not really.
I still see the man that was sitting in the French Marketplace on Santa Monica Boulevard the day I met him.
I still see that guy as dodging traffic coming across the street.
But you can see it in our faces and stuff. Our faces are drawn and sort of skeletal, you know, from the drugs. They do that.
It has affected our appearances, most definitely, but it hasn't affected our smiles. They're still the same, and they still mean the same. And, you know, and that twinkling in the eyes that we've always had with each other and for each other, that's still the same. That hasn't ever changed. Maybe it's brighter now than it's ever been, really.
Do you guys feel older than you should feel? I mean, you're both, what, you're 60, 63 now? Is that about right?
That's exactly right.
I'm 63, and Dennis is 60.
Do we feel older? Well, when we get up and move around, yeah, we feel a little bit ancient. But in our hearts and in our souls, we actually don't feel anywhere near this age. But, yeah, you feel the aches and pains and the joints creaking and all of that, yeah.
Larry, what about you? If I were to say, you know, where do you see yourself advancing faster than you perhaps should be in age? When you look in the mirror, what do you see? What would you comment on?
When I look in the mirror, of course, I see myself older. But I'm with Dennis. You know, our thinking has stayed young. We talk about our GI systems, and I have the GI system of an 80-year-old. You know, I have to worry about... There's this old saying about it, when a guy who's addicted to alcohol walks into a party, he knows immediately how much alcohol is in the room. We're like that with bathrooms. First thing we do is check out where the bathroom is, you know. So that's probably the most difficult thing.
Well, the thing is, I bet you guys have taken pretty good care of yourself. Most of the gay guys that I know are you know, stay fitter long past the time when my belt goes, you know, a couple of notches out. And you eat carefully, that sort of thing. I don't know if I'm making a generalization there, but it seems I'm right.
We do. We both cook, and we cook well, and we cook healthy. We both go to the gym. And we go to a gym that has a lot of older people who go to it, and we see so many of those people who are our age or slightly older, who can barely move, and we're still doing treadmills and that sort of thing. And I think that has a lot to do with finding out that we had something wrong with us so long ago that if we had any chance whatsoever of surviving it or having any quality of life and the energy to enjoy life and engage life, we had to work hard at it.
One of our main problems is just the opposite of what you're talking about with your couple of notches. My notches go the other way. I have to work hard to keep my weight at an acceptable level. I weigh 140. I was a 155-pound man when I started all of this.
How tall are you, Larry?
I'm 5'9".
Okay.
And I have to really, really work to stay up to 140. Because if I should get ill, I don't have very much reserve.
I'm talking with Larry Gibson and Dennis Golay. The two men are now their own small part of medical history, having both survived over 20 years as a couple with HIV/AIDS. Larry's recently been undergoing a number of painful injections to restore some of the shape to his face.
Have you ever seen a man with an AIDS face?
I don't think I know what an AIDS face is.
Well, your cheeks are sunken in very far, as a matter, because you lose your muscle tone, where most people have rosy round cheeks. Those are gone. It's just bone. And so the skin that's left just sinks in. And it causes medical problems because you bite your mouth inside a lot because you don't have the flesh there that keeps your face where it's supposed to be.
And you cut yourself shaving.
Yeah.
So as my doctor, who's one of the most brilliant HIV specialists in the country, says, if a woman goes in with breast cancer and has a mastectomy and loses her breasts, well, you would do a prosthetic or you would rebuild the breast for that, right? Mm-hmm. So if your face looks like you just came out of Auschwitz, then why not do something for that, too? I mean, so it is a matter of just appearing normal in public, which is a nice thing. So, and it has filled my face out. I can now shave without slashing myself to pieces. And I'm not biting myself like I was. And I look, you know, I look like an old guy. But I look okay, you know. I don't look skeletal anymore.
I wonder if you guys ever feel a little bit like medical curiosities because you have, you know, lived so long and lived so well after getting this kind of, you know, you have months to live death sentence.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I think you got something there. We think we're a medical curiosity because we've never known another couple that survived like we have. For us to still be an original couple with HIV is nothing short of amazing to both of us.
That is definitely a curiosity, yeah.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Treatments for HIV/AIDS have given Larry Gibson and Dennis Golay reason to think and talk about a future. I ask them what worries them most.
I think what we're most worried about is becoming too soon unable to take care of ourselves or each other. This really preys on my mind. I do not want to be in a nursing home at 66.
Yeah, long-term care is definitely a concern of everybody. But I kind of see that for me at some point. And yeah, that worries us. And there's not much in place for that, certainly not for people like us.
One of the things about growing old with HIV/AIDS is that I bet you probably don't have that many of your friends from younger years who are growing old with you.
We don't have any of them to speak of. Most of the friends that we have now are friends that are 10 years or less.
Right. We lost everybody in L.A. We lost everybody.
Our entire circle of friends. And we had a really nice circle of 50, 60, maybe 70 people in Los Angeles.
Right.
We're the only two left.
There must be one couple, some guy from then, no?
No, not one.
No. We're the longest surviving HIV couple that we know of.
I'd love to get in touch with others who have better statistics.
Right. Yeah, I bet the doctors would, too. But, I mean, it's been 20 years since your diagnosis, not since you got together. It's been 20 years since you tested positive.
Since the diagnosis. That's right.
Do you feel like you're living on borrowed time, like this is a blessing? Or do you feel a little bit cheated that you got through the AIDS and now it's like, oh, are we going to be cut short again?
I don't really feel like we're living on borrowed time, but I most definitely feel that we are blessed.
We feel like we're living on golden time.
That's a good word. But no, I don't feel like we're living on borrowed time. I don't know what that means exactly. I don't know where we'll be a year from now or 5 years from now if God gives us that much. It would sound stupid of me to say AIDS is a blessing. But what AIDS did for our psyche was a blessing because we became the people that we knew we were inside but probably would have postponed for who knows, maybe all of our lives like a lot of people do. And I continue to feel blessed.
One quiet morning when I was out by myself, 4:30 in the morning, and I saw a star, you know, when you wish upon a star. I asked for, very sincerely, and not for myself, not for my life, not for Dennis's life, but I asked for what we have, that it mature. That's what I asked for 20 years. And we got it, so we don't feel cheated at all.
Do you plan anniversaries?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. 25th anniversary is great.
Now, are we planning 30 now?
I want to see 50.
I would, too.
I mean, not 50 years old, 50th anniversary. I'd love to see it.
We're going to have souped-up hover rounds, I think, at that time.
We're going to have we're going to have matching electric scooters. I wish everybody could be as much in love as we are. I really do. I wish the whole world could be as much in love as we are.
We're feeling positive enough about the future that we just adopted a new puppy on Monday.
She's 6 months old.
She's 6 months old.
So oh, yeah, your work cut out for you.
Yeah. She's a sweetheart, though.
Larry Gibson and Dennis Golay live in Palm Springs, California. Thanks to Mary Engel with the LA Times for helping connect us with Larry and Dennis. If you have your own story to share about a moment of personal transformation or an adventure that you've been through, you can always contact me at our website, thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
I have some good advice for everyone within the sound of my voice. Go out and vote because you've got the choice.
And if you've been following the political conversations we're having here on The Story, you'll know that we're trying to stay away from the latest tally of superdelegates and trying to concentrate on the personal stories of politics, moments when you've been drawn in or changed, perhaps one time when you saw that real change or real transformation was possible through political action. One of our recent storytellers was Phyllis Barnwell, talking about the first time she voted. As it turned out, Phyllis's 21st birthday and Election Day, 1952, were the same day, so Phyllis had to fight for the right to register and vote on the same day. For an African-American girl in Connecticut back in the 50s, this made the news.
Well, after all those years of working and hoping that people would get up and get out and vote, it was my turn. I didn't think it was fair that I had to wait. In order to vote, it would be 4 years before I could vote for a president again. And, of course, they're going to have an election for something else, but that would be a year from now. But I'd been waiting all this time.
Deborah Kaufman wrote in to tell me her story. She grew up in the Midwest. She moved to Iowa when she was heading into the eighth grade. And that summer, she and all her friends did what most girls their age did in the summertime. They worked in the fields, detasseling corn.
It was all flat corn country, humid, hot in the summertime, and the corn grows really high. And this was popcorn that we were detasseling.
So are you taking the silk off?
Yeah. You're taking the tassel, the flower. You don't want it to pollinate itself, which it will do if you keep the flower on. You want the male corn that is in the outer rows to blow across the female corn and pollinate, so you get the hybrid.
And that's how you get the best popcorn.
Absolutely.
See?
Yep, that's
something
it.
I had no idea.
There
but
you go.
So actually, what are you doing? Do you have to take a little flower off each ear?
It's a big tassel that it pulls out, you know, like kind of almost.
But off the top of the stalk
off the
or
off of the stalk?
Off the each ear of
no,
the corn?
Off the top of the stalk. There's only one. It's not that little fuzzy stuff you see on per ear of corn. It's the very top flower that blows up in the breeze. And it gets quite tall.
Yeah, how old would you have been when you were doing this?
So I was 14, going into eighth grade.
You must have been doing it early in the summer so the corn's not 5-6 feet tall, or are you actually having to pull it over to do this?
You are. It's quite tall. And so what you do is there are these machines, a tractor that has these arms, two arms that go out, and then each arm has three kind of baskets that hang down that you stand in. And so your basket is lowered according to the height, but the arms go up above the corn so that you're It can graze them, and you're in a basket.
Pulling the
sometimes
top.
Two to a basket. If the first pass, you need to have more manpower. There would be two girls in a basket.
And sounds like it might be hard summer work.
It was very hard. It was very hard, very hot, long hours. You'd get up in the morning early on, and it was usually quite cold and or not cold, but chilly and wet. Dew. In the morning.
How many girls would go at one time, Dad?
Well, they picked up. Our crew was about maybe 20, and I don't know. I think there were 12 at the most of us on a machine, and I think sometimes as few as 6, depending on how dense it was that needed to be pulled. So we would. I don't know. For some reason, we didn't wear gloves. Don't ask me why.
Could you cut yourself on this, or what?
Yeah, not so much cut, but some of the tassels were harder to pull. Sometimes they'd come right out, and sometimes they'd be just sticky with black aphids, and they'd be like really gross and slimy.
Get this all over your hands?
Right, all over your hands, under your fingernails. It was really gross. And grasshoppers would be blowing, flying it all over you. And I'm kind of a bug phobe, so it was not, I had really no idea what it was going to be like. But, all my friends were doing it, so.
No, I guess you're doing it because there's not fast food places everywhere.
Exactly.
Where you get to put on a uniform and do. But was this just money for the next school year?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
This was your spending money, right?
Yeah, if you wanted school clothes, that's what you did. Yeah.
And how long would the summer job last?
It was somewhere between 4 and 6 weeks, kind of depending on the crop. 6 was usually the longest it would go.
And this detasseling work, was this girls' work?
Yes. The girls did the detasseling. And historically, I guess, always have. My mother detasseled in Illinois. So, yeah, it was the girls did the detasseling. There were no boys on our crew at all.
Were the boys doing any kind of field work?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The boys, of course, were baling hay, which was terrible, hot work as well. But what we found out, almost by accident, is that one day we were placed in a field next to where boys were doing roguing, which is...
It's another verb you're going to have to define for me.
It's a great word. You take this utensil, and it's got a hook like a sickle end to it. And I guess they were taking out... they never tell you what you're doing. You just show up and do these things.
They show you how to do it, and you do
right.
it, right?
And they were pulling what I think was male corn that they didn't want in there. Thus the rogue. And so they would take them out when they were quite young, I guess, just to
cutting
just
ears
remove
off
it.
The stalk?
The whole stalk at the bottom, so the sickle was near the ground.
Right.
And I think they must have been short-staffed because, as I was remembering it, we actually were doing it for a period of time in that field. It was just a one-day deal. So we were talking with the boys, comparing notes, and we found out that they made 25 cents an hour more than we did. So we were outraged.
When was this? What year are we talking about?
1965. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how much were they making?
So we were making a dollar an hour, so they were making $1.25. We knew they made more money baling, and it didn't really bother us because we knew that was really hard work. But since we had done the roguing, we're like, this is not hard. Why are they getting 25 cents more an hour? So we got really outraged, and we started talking among ourselves in the truck on the way back, just like fomenting. And I don't know exactly how it happened, or it was such a collective thing. I don't remember one person coming up with the idea, but we hatched this idea that we needed to have a sit-down strike and ask for the same wage the boys were getting.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Deborah Kaufman was working in the cornfields of Iowa in the summer of 1965. Now, that was also the time when this country was in the middle of the civil rights movement. And Deborah and her friends had been watching that closely.
We heard about the sit-ins. I think sit-down strikes were even older than that and hadn't really been used as a strike. But, yeah, the sit-ins were really the inspiration for that. We had read about
now,
them.
Was it your idea, you and the other girls, or was there some Marxist socialist parent who was feeding these ideas
to
you?
No, this is Republican country. All of our parents were Republicans. And it was totally came from us. And we started talking, yeah, that's what we should do. Let's have a sit-down strike.
So what was the plan, to get off the truck one day and just sit down?
No,
and say, okay.
What we did know somehow, I don't know how this information comes to us, but we knew that they needed us, that there weren't a whole lot of other girls around to do this, and that we were in the height of detasseling season that had a very finite period of time. If you don't get those tassels before they flower, then they're going to pollinate. bad, bad, bad.
This is the transit strike at rush hour time, right?
Right, exactly. Use that momentum. So we decided we were going to do that. So we picked the date. We picked a spokesperson, or she kind of volunteered, I think. And we decided when we were going to do it. And so we talked about it, I would say, at least a week every day. We would talk about it in the fields, and we would talk about it on the truck.
Did you think you were going to do this, Deborah, or did it feel at that time like it was just one of these great things to talk about, like, let's build a tree for it,
right.
And you never do, you know?
Well, I was hoping we were going to do it, but it was very scary. Even though we felt, you know, the time was on our side and that we would really have a lot to gain from it, it was also very, very scary. These are not, you know, we're good girls, you know. We're farm kids and small-town kids. So it took a lot of guts, but it was so much the fact that we were bolstering each other. And so when the day came... We chose the day.
What were you going to do? You were going to sit down, but were you going to confront somebody?
Well, you know, we didn't really have it that planned out. We just said, we're going to do it at noon. We're going to announce it that we're going to have it. And then we thought, what if he calls our bluff, you know, or what if we don't, some of us don't sit down, some of us do. But you just really couldn't go there. You were trying to just go day by day, step by step. So
spokesperson that you've chosen, were you sure that she was going to be able to go through with this?
You're never sure, really. But she was gutsy. She was actually the youngest one in our group.
Oh, and I would have thought she'd be older.
I know. So I think maybe she felt like she had, you know, something
to prove.
She'd
have been, 12, 13 years old?
Yeah. She was a year behind us in school. And she was like, I'll do it. And we're like, oh, all right. And so when the day came, we were just so, so, so nervous. You know, I remember just, I couldn't eat my sandwich, and I was just like sitting there because we were doing it at a lunch hour.
Which was in the field?
It was in the farmer's yard. You know, he had some trees that we would sit down in. And
so was that the guy that you had to as well?
Yeah, that was the big farmer. He was a very wealthy farmer. He had, I don't know, thousands of acres or...
But he wasn't with you every day.
No. We never saw him. I had never met him before in my life. I didn't know what he looked
like. Oh, so your spokesperson is going to confront this mystery.
Right. Mystery man.
Okay.
Mr. King, I think his name was. So we were really nervous and we were all looking at each other. And I was thinking, we're probably going to chicken out. And I remember kept looking at Barb and I could see how nervous she was.
That was your spokesperson.
Yeah. So we were buzzing and whispering. And she's like, she was going to do it. It was clear. I was really excited and nervous. So she got up and she said to, there was a supervisor who was a hired hand of the farmers who was there. And she told him, would you ask Mr. King to come out? We want to speak with him. So he goes out. Mr. King comes out, tall, very nice looking man.
And you're doing this boom, boom.
Yeah,
boom,
we're all just nervous, like, what is going to happen? You know, he's going to fire us.
And Barb is still standing up there, right?
Yeah, she's standing there under the tree. And I was sure that he was going to say, get out of here, you know, forget it, you're fired or whatever. So he came out and he said, girls, before you say a single word, I just want to tell you, you're all getting the same pay as the boys. And we just like, hurrah, you know, we cheer rose up and we were just giddy. We couldn't believe it.
How do you think he found out, or do you know how he found out?
Well, you know, we were mystified. It's like, how did he know? How did he know? How did he know?
He's Mr. King. He knows everything.
Mr. King, yeah, how did he know? And it wasn't until quite a bit later that I realized that his hired man who was spot checking us, you know, I don't think we were as subtle as we thought we were, and we're talking among ourselves in the rows. I'm sure he heard us hatching our plan and had told him everything about it. So
that's actually kind of cool, though, that he would just diffuse it by saying, yeah, sure, you'll make the same as the boys, because the fact that you were already slightly at a disadvantage would have meant that he could just as equally have said, sorry, that's what you're going to get.
I know. And I think if he had, we probably would have still gone on working. You know, because that was our school money. So it was such a huge victory. It was amazing. We couldn't believe it.
Did your wages go up as of that moment?
Not only that, but he made it retroactive. So the whole summer, we were going to get a 25% raise from $1 to $1.25. I'd never made a raise that big in my life.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Deborah Kaufman found that the decision to take action and the resulting success was intoxicating. Even today, she looks back on that summer as a real political awakening for her.
There was no women's movement. I mean, of course, there were many women's movements, but there was not the new women's movement that came about in the early 1970s. So we didn't have any sense of girl power or anything like that. It was just the injustice of not being paid the same amount as the boys that just at a very basic level really rankled.
Do you remember telling your mother?
You know, it's funny. We didn't tell our parents that we were going to do it. I know I didn't tell mine.
That makes sense.
I think they wouldn't have liked it. And I don't remember if I even, it's funny, I don't remember if I even told them that we had done it. You know, your life is
so separate.
So it wasn't
like a daughter-mother thing, guess what?
No. My parents would have been very nervous if I had told them we were going to do that.
Don't mess with Mr. King.
Yeah, he's the boss. You don't do things like that.
But I interrupted you. You were saying this was actually something of a political awakening for you.
Absolutely. And later on when I got more involved in political work, the women's movement initially, I remembered that we had done this and had a victory, which was really big, you know, that we had some collective wisdom that we didn't even know that we had at that age.
And power.
Absolutely. The power of the collective in the workplace.
So where would I have found your political activity in later years? Did you protest during the Vietnam War?
Sort of thing? So later on, I was involved. I was a freshman in college when Kent State happened. And I remember most of these things were spontaneous. The other thing I remember doing was, at that time, girls had a curfew in college and boys did not. This was University of Iowa. And we were outraged about that too. So we had a walkout or something, where we deliberately stayed out past curfew. Everybody in the dorm, or not everybody, but a whole bunch of us. And we had to go before the student court, and tell them our story. And we all told them that we thought it was unfair that girls had curfew and boys didn't. And the next year, the curfew was gone. It was the times were changing, you know. So it wasn't, I don't think, just that.
But still, to have won a political battle at such a young age, though, would, I imagine, have given you the confidence that a lot of other kids didn't have, that you could actually make something change.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I really think that's true.
Are you ever in touch with any of the other girls who were in the field with you on that
day? Yes, I'm still really good friends with my one friend, Kathy. Yeah, and we talked about that story not so long ago, because all of us took such different paths. That place where we grew up, there was not much expected from us. The school was not a particularly good school, and nobody really urged us to go to college. Whatever we did really came from us, not from our parents or from anybody else telling us how great we were.
But it makes it more personal.
Absolutely.
It's your own pursuit of justice.
Absolutely. And I really believe having that early win made a difference. Because I was involved in a union organizing thing at a restaurant, which went totally bust. But I still believe.
But not because you didn't join in, right?
Right, exactly. It was like we tried everything. They defeated us. But still, it was the same thing where you really got a sense of, where are you going to draw the line? You know, are you for us or are you against us? Are you going to be bought out by the establishment, which is one technique they often used to split you up, or are you going to stick with the group? So it was really interesting because it was, for me, it was about integrity and sticking with your group.
Do you think that even today, Deborah, it gives you a different perspective on politics, that you can do something?
Yes.
Because we hear so much from people who go, you know, well, the fix is in. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. We can't make a difference.
Right. And I think there can be cause for despair if you really think about your own little tiny piece that you can do. But it's really in joining with other people. That's where you have power.
Detasseling in 1965. It's a great start. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Deborah Kaufman joined me with her political story here in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, in our story studios. Now, what about you? In all the political coverage that we're hearing, I think what's missing are the personal stories about those political moments that make a difference in your life. For some people, it's simple. It's the very first time they voted. Now, for others, it's one of those unexpected encounters with politics or a politician, something that really made a difference in their lives. Or like Deborah, an adventure, a discovery of how power can be exercised. Politics doesn't lack for passion. And I'm not asking you why you might be passionate about one candidate or one issue. I'm looking for those personal stories. Stuff about you. All you have to do is send me a few lines about your story. Go to our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.